Did you meet any new relatives?
Yeah, so as I think I said last time, you know, Ivazovsky had four daughters, and it's the easiest way to consider the family is by using the names of the four husbands. And the four husbands were Lampsy, Latry, Hansen, and Artsulov. We belonged to the Lampsy line, and there was another relative named Tatiana who lived in Paris until 2003. But since she's died, the only remaining relatives from that line are the 27 living family in Australia. The Latry family live in the UK, and they didn't attend the celebrations. Which, you know, we were very disappointed about that. But you know, Henry, who's the eldest, is 90 years old, and understandably would find travel difficult now. The third line, Hansen, was represented by Irina Kazetskaya. She's the lady who lives in Armenia but works for a Russian agency. Her ancestor was named Olympiada, and she was a widow with children who married Alexis Hansen, who came from the Ivazovsky line. They didn't have any children together, so Irina is descended from one of those children who is related by marriage rather than by blood. But, you know, as I felt about my step-grandfather, she considers him as her ancestor. As far as we knew at the time, the Artsulov line continued in the USA, and Irina mentioned that she'd found someone, but that was all that we knew about. So when we arrived, we finally met Irina at Domodedovo Airport. She brought a girl to interpret for her. She doesn't speak much English at all, so that we could understand about her excitement and the gifts that she'd given to us. Then when we finally got to Feodosia, on the first afternoon in Feodosia, we attended a book launch as the gallery had produced a new catalogue. I gave a short speech, and then a man in a white outfit stood up and called me back out again and presented me with an Ivazovsky calendar. And unbeknownst to me, this was actually one of the Artsulov relatives. This was the new relative. His grandmother was married to one of the Artsulov boys, and he brought along his wife to find out that he had in fact got a whole new family in Australia. Mm. So hopefully at some point he'll come and visit us.
Did you visit Ivan Ivazovsky's resting place?
Yes, on July the 29th, as we intended, the anniversary date, we attended St. Sarkis Armenian Apostolic Church in Feodosia. The grounds of the church are very well maintained, though the church is very old. And in the grounds is the Ivazovsky grave. The grave, in fact, looked pristine, and that was because Bishop Ezras had committed funds to have the grave site renovated. If you see old, you know, some photos from maybe 30, 40 years ago, the marble looks very stained and chipped in places. And when we came to see it, it was pristine. This is a measure of you know, Armenian pride for Ivazovsky. The grave is relatively visited by tourists, but the renovation of it is undertaken by Armenians. On the day when we were there, there were three phases of people who attended the grave. The first group were the political group, who had things to say about Ivazovsky and what he means to Russia. Then there were the Armenians and the family, including the Archbishop. And finally, when we'd finished and paid our respects, the townspeople came in to pay respects as well. So we attended the grave. We laid some carnations, as did most other people, and then we followed Bishop Ezras into the church and stayed for the memorial service. While we were there, we learnt that Ivazovsky, in fact, had been baptised there, had sung there, and also subsequently had been buried there. So that was his home church for his whole life. Mm.
And did you meet any locals who had personal stories about Ivazovsky?
Yes, the locals did relate to stories about Ivazovsky. We found out that, in fact, he was a short man, probably not even 5 feet tall, which is about the same size as my grandmother Varva was. When we were told this and we looked at his self-portraits, we said, oh, he doesn't look like he's 5 feet tall. And the director of the gallery, who was a local, said, oh, no, he used to paint himself tall so that he could put all his medals onto his jacket for the painting. But in real life, when he went out to put medals on, he was so short he didn't have enough room on his jackets to wear them all at once. He had to pick and choose which jewellery he would wear. Many years ago, Varva told us about a third brother called Karumba, who she said was Ivazovsky's brother and a Black Sea pirate. We found out, in fact, that Ivazovsky did have two brothers and two sisters. One of the brothers you know is Gabriel Ivazovsky, who was an Armenian apostolic bishop in Tbilisi. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that Karumba was actually Ivazovsky's nephew, not his son, and that he was no Black Sea pirate. He was, as the life of Brian says, he was just a very naughty boy. Tatiana Gaiduk is the gallery director, and she's actually a Feodosia local. And she told us about Ivazovsky's estate, which was called Sheikh Mamai. The story goes that Khan Mamai was a Golden Horde governor and military leader in the area who lost an important battle to the Russians and after that fled to Feodosia. Feodosia was controlled by the Genoese at the time, and they were worried that the Golden Horde would actually come and, you know, exact some kind of revenge for accommodating Mamai. So Mamai was beheaded by the Genoese and his head stored in salt for transportation to the rulers in the hope that there would be no ramifications for having him in their midst. Ivazovsky apparently did the historical research and concluded that Mamai was actually buried on his property. And he narrowed the burial site of the beheaded body to a particular point and built a rotunda over that spot. Apparently in the 1920s, the pavilion was demolished and archaeologists dug underneath the pavilion and dug up a beheaded body which was buried with jewels. So it appears that his research was accurate. Sheikh Mamai was one of his estates that was engaged in agriculture, and we were told that after about 1860, Ivazovsky had no need to sell paintings as his properties and investments had made him already independently rich from his painting income, and so that after that point in time, he used his painting income for charity. We were told also, as we were wandering around the gallery, which used to be his house, that he actually conducted meals at home in a formal setting, and that he had three recognised meal types. There was meals for family, meals for visitors, and meals for nobility. The meals that were served in multiples of 30 courses. So the family got 30 courses, the visitors got 60 courses, and the nobility got 90 courses. The notion of a course, however, was a bit different to what we think of as a course. So that, for instance, Spanish olives and Italian olives would have constituted two courses. One of the things that we knew about that we didn't understand the scope of was his generosity. So we'd read that he'd supplied water to the town, but that doesn't quite tell the whole story. He supplied water from his estate to the town by building a ceramic water line to the town to interface with the existing pipes. And he had to put in a pumping station because of the terrain. And the flow rate had to be at least 25,000 pails a day. So as we set out for Yalta on the 30th of July, I asked where the estate was situated. And Tatiana, the director, said that she would show me. So we drove out of town, and as we were pulling into the next town along the road, which is a place called Stary Krym, she indicated a road off to her right and said the estate was about 3 to 4 kilometres up that road. By that stage, we were 30 kilometres from Feodosia. That's like Shepparton to Numurkah. Right? So he'd built a water supply line over 30 kilometres with a pumping station. I suspect that such an endeavour today would have cost several million. Mm. But that was done out of his out of his own pocket.
Did you travel outside of Crimea?
No, we didn't travel outside of Crimea, but we did travel most of the south coast of the Crimea. Tatiana, the gallery director, Tatiana Gaiduk, arranged a day visit for us to Yalta to see some things that were associated with the family. So we travelled from Feodosia to Alupta, where we went to the Vorontsov Palace. At the Vorontsov Palace, we looked at the work of Alexander Greaves, who was Julia Greaves' uncle. Julia was Ivazovsky's first wife and the mother of his four children. So Alexander Greaves was the librarian who catalogue the holdings of the library at the Vorontsov Palace. While we were in the area, we also saw two properties that were owned by Helen, one of Ivazovsky's daughters. She, in fact, married the governor of the Crimea and ran a bathhouse in the on the Yalta promenade beside the hotels. That's a bathhouse in a good sense of the word, a place where you go to get washed. The hotels apparently had no bathing facilities, so she realised there was a need and built the bathing facilities in a nearby building. And apparently it was a great business. While we were in that area, we also visited the Livadia Palace, which was the summer home of the Tsar and the site of the World War II Yalta Conference, where Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt determined the shape of the post-World War II world. The conference area is still set up in the inside the building, and the Italianate building was gorgeous with the sunset as it was sitting above the Yalta coast. That side trip was not really planned, and we were introduced to the staff who were there as the family of Ivazovsky, and subsequently taken on a trip through the place where we were shown things that other people don't normally see.
Any other highlights or events we missed?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I'd like to talk about. So while I was in Feodosia, I woke on the Saturday morning before we were going to Yalta, and it was early, and so I sat outside to watch the sunrise. And if you've seen Ivazovsky paintings, I was blessed with a sunrise very similar to some of those, which was a good omen. It also the trip also made me think about the notion of fame, and particularly fame in Australia. You know, we've got some famous figures who have comparable levels of fame to Ivazovsky, like Ned Kelly, but the similarity ends there. You know, Ivazovsky's fame was not tarnished by any hint of infamy. If I could characterise his life, it was poor boy makes good and never forgets where he came from. You know, his time when the family were exceptionally poor in the cafes on Feodosia's waterfront seems to have fit him for living with people, and almost to a man, the people that he met were on his side. The only one that I can find who wasn't on his side was the painter Philippe Tanner. And in fact, he helped him get introduced to the Tsar. And that was the thing that projected his career into the stratosphere of painting. Now, his first painting, which was the subject of argument between Tanner and Ivazovsky, was actually bought by the Tsar for 1,000 rubles, which is about three times the average middle-class wage at the time, which would be like buying selling your first painting here for about $400,000. At all of the public meetings, we were asked three questions. Do you have any Ivazovsky paintings? Does anyone in the family have the Ivazovsky painting ability? And what do you think about the situation in Crimea? Now, we don't have any Ivazovsky paintings in the Australian family. Dr. Henry Sanford from the Lartrey family has three or four originals. And these were actually cut from their frames as the Bolsheviks were entering the family home, as they exited the Crimea. There were two people in the Australian family who have got some artistic ability, though neither would regard themselves as professional. My daughter Alexis draws well, and Frederica's mother Lucy paints watercolours for relaxation. Amanda, who travelled with us, is very keen on the idea of an Ivazovsky exhibition in Australia. We were told that it is difficult, and we understand that is the case. But, you know, in Australia, we've had the Hermitage collection and a Turner collection in recent times. So we know it's possible to have that done. And if SBS would like to consider a sponsorship of this, I'm sure she'd be grateful to hear from you. The issue of Crimea is far more vexatious. The view of the Crimeans that we met is that the matter was settled in the 2014 referendum. Crimean life itself seems very settled, and the only impositions you can find because of their current status is associated with interfacing to international things like communications, flights, banks, etc. I know that the Tatars, who are a minority in the area, didn't agree with the reassociation with Russia. However, after visiting and reading about the local geopolitics, I do have some sympathy for Crimea, it seems that, that everybody but the Crimeans take a role in determining their outcomes. And at some time, pragmatism may help determine the outcome. I mean, personally, I think I should, I'd like to apologise to the Australian and Ukrainian governments for travelling to the Crimea. But as a family member, our aim was to be in Feodosia on July the 29th, 2017. And so we had no choice but to travel by Russia. We had no intention of buying into geopolitical arguments about sovereignty and self-determination. Lastly, I'd like to express my thanks and my affection for Irina Kazatskaya. Our trip was such an experience because she put in the work to arrange the meetings. At these meetings, she stepped back and allowed us to have the limelight. I think that she did this for no other benefit than to be with us and to lead us to a better understanding of our family heritage. You know, she was the glue that's bonded the Ivazovsky relatives, has raised our knowledge, our understanding, and our pride about the man that we're related to. And she gave us the experience of a lifetime. You know, she was the true hero of the trip in my eyes. And you know, I hope you've got someone like her in your family.
Professor Andrew, thank you very much for your time and interview, and it was a pleasure again talking to you.
Thank you very much, Vahe.